Okay, so we'll continue with the little section on emptiness from chapter 12, and which is Acharyamrita, and that should we should wrap it up today. We'll see. Even though emptiness was not the most frequent subject of the Buddha's teachings, it was plainly one that he saw to be of great importance. The following passages indicate the profound and essential quality that the Buddha saw in the development of the insight into emptiness and the need to encourage its realization in his disciples, both monastic and lay. And this next quote is from Samyutta 20, Sutta number 7. Bhikkhus, once in the past, the Dasarahas had a kettle drum called the summoner. When the summoner became cracked, the Dasarahas inserted another peg. Eventually, the time came when the summoner's original drumhead had disappeared and only a collection of pegs remained. So too, bhikkhus, the same thing will happen with the bhikkhus in the future. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep in meaning, supramundane, dealing with emptiness, are being recited, they will not be eager to listen to them, nor lend an ear to them, nor apply their minds to understand them, and they will not think those teachings should be studied and mastered. But when those discourses that are mere poetry, composed by poets, beautiful in words and phrases, created by outsiders, spoken by their disciples, are being recited, they will be eager to listen to them, will lend an ear to them, will apply their minds to understand them, and they will think those teachings should be studied and mastered. In this way, bhikkhus, those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep in meaning, supramundane, dealing with emptiness, will disappear. Therefore, bhikkhus, you should train yourselves thus. When those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep in meaning, supramundane, dealing with emptiness, are being recited, we will be eager to listen to them, will lend an ear to them, will apply our minds to understand them, and we will think those teachings should be studied and mastered. Thus should you train yourselves. So it's just a admonition from the Buddha looking into the future and realizing human nature is what it is, and things that are really important get kind of cast aside or just neglected, and there needs to be a special effort to really pay attention to what is it that is the essence of the Buddha's teaching. What's really important, and I think that it's we're 2,500 years plus since the Buddha was here teaching, and we are incredibly fortunate to have these teachings still with us. And there's a huge array of variety of teachings that are around, so that just really cultivating a discernment and an interest to sort of how do we really give ourselves the optimum opportunity to really dig down into the deeper teachings. It doesn't mean you neglect the foundations or neglect the basis of practice, but those are related as well. I mean, it's like the It's like when Ajahn Chah went to America. I mean, he only made one trip to America. And the way that Ajahn Chah kind of works, he doesn't really have a plan of what he's going to say or teach or do from day to day, moment to moment. But when he got there and got to a retreat that was going on, then and then went to a few other places that were sort of there or were teaching Buddhism, and his emphasis was on sila, and he emphasized sila over and over and over again. Actually, Jack, at one point in time, I'm not sure when it was, Jack
At
Kornfield
the IMS.
at IMS, but he asked him, well, Jack is very sort of enthusiastic kind of person. Jack, well, Paul, what do you think about Buddhism and Buddhist teachings coming to the West now? And Lopa sort of gave him this kind of deadpan look. He said, I haven't seen any Buddhism here yet. Poor Jack.
Poor Jack.
Poor Jack.
Oh, yeah, I think that was at IMS.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. Also, he was, when he was talking about Sila, Lumbo Cha couldn't understand English at all, but he was a very good, very observant person and could read body language and could read a room or a group of people very, very clearly. And so when he was speaking about Sila at, on this retreat at IMS, and he was, and then Jack was translating for him. Ajahn Babakaro was sort of sitting to one side, who also spoke extremely good Thai. Jack's Thai is pretty good. He lived there for quite some time. And then Lumpu Cha was watching the group and realizing he's not saying what I'm saying. Because he would make a statement, and then he just could tell by the way that people were responding that, that's not the way that that kind of comment usually is received. And he figured that out. Then he, and apparently it's on the recording. I haven't listened to it myself. And then he turned to Jack and said, "Tell them that you're not saying what I'm saying." To his credit, Jack did. Did a big laugh, but he still couldn't help editing what Lumpu Cha was saying because he thought it would be off-putting or wasn't as sort of as sort of liberation focused or enlightenment focused as he had, was aiming for, what Jack was hoping for. Also, with that, I very deliberately included that teaching about the drum of the Dasarahas and how, because being one who is prone to writing poetry and decorating the teachings and dressing things up in all sorts of hopefully appealing and digestible ways, then there's a certain kind of embarrassment to like, I think I know one of the people this might be talking about, but I do feel it's important that to understand that the Buddha didn't dismiss poetic expression. So the whole of the Dhammapada, it's all very precise, metrical poetic form. The Sutta Nipata, similarly, it's a whole the whole set of teachings, very, very profound teachings in the Sutta Nipata. And the Dhammapada are all in poetic form. So he's not dismissing elegant and so beautiful language per se, but what he's saying in that teaching is if that becomes a priority and becomes more important than the content and the purpose of what's being said or written is more to kind of dazzle the reader, the listener, rather than to convey profound teachings, then think the cart is being put before the horse, as it were. Things are the wrong way around. And so I feel that's extremely good advice. And so in terms of of those of us who have put quite a few books together, one kind or another. I feel that's really an important ethic to have in mind. How it's expressed is one thing, but is this primarily in order to convey this meaning to the reader or to the listener? Or is this just to sort of impress or dazzle or kind of say something so poetic or impactful?
Yeah, because even the Buddha, I mean, you see it throughout many, many discourses. He'll wrap things up with a poetic verse. And it was, I mean, it's not, I mean, I would think in Indian culture, it was something that was considered really very prized to be able to do that. And then there's one of the monks.
Vangisa.
Eh?
Vangisa.
Vangisa, thank you. Vangisa is foremost in the expression of the Dhamma in verse form, spontaneous verses. And similarly in, say, Isan culture, very, very prized this ability to make spontaneous verse and to not just to rhyme, but to make sense and carry through an intellectual theme. But yeah, there's fluff and there's the real theme.
It is, there's a whole section of the whole chapter of the Connected Discourses dedicated to Vangisa, the Vangisa
Sanyutta.
And it's interesting how, you know, Vangisa was like a professional poet before he became a monk. That was his livelihood, and this kind of spontaneous versifying, he was particularly good at that. And then when he became a monk, and then in the Vangisa Sanyutta, I think a few other places as well, but primarily, Vangisa will be sitting there listening to a teaching, and he'll say, "Venerable sir, a verse has occurred to me." And then the Buddha says, "Oh, please, please, Vangisa, speak. You know, let these words be spoken. Let your verse be expressed." And there's no time and. Who knows what happened in those instances, but the Buddha never says, "Please, Vangisa, not again."
Not yet.
You know, please, just kind of ramp it down on the poetics. He says, "Please, let the verses occur to you. Come on, speak up, and then share that with everybody." So he was not suppressing that, but I think it's the prioritizing the meaning over the trying to be impressive or poetic or elegant in the speech. That's the key piece there.
Okay. Any comments, questions? Okay, next there's a further sutta from the Sanyutta 55, sutta number 53. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Bharanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. Then the lay follower Dhammadina, together with 500 lay disciples, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. Sitting to one side, the lay follower Dhammadina then said to the Blessed One, "Let the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, exhort us and instruct us in a way that may lead to our welfare and happiness for a long time. Therefore, Dhammadina, you should train yourselves thus. From time to time, we will enter and dwell upon those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep, deep in meaning, super mundane, dealing with emptiness. It is in such a way that you should train yourselves. Venerable Sir, it is not easy for us, dwelling in a home crowded with children, enjoying khasi and sandalwood, wearing garlands, scents, and cosmetics, receiving gold and silver, from time, to enter and dwell upon those discourses spoken by the Tathagata that are deep, deep in meaning, super mundane, dealing with emptiness. As we are established in the five training rules, let the Blessed One teach us the Dhamma further. Therefore, Dhammadina, You should train yourselves thus. We will possess confirmed confidence in the Buddha. We will possess confirmed confidence in the Dhamma. We will possess confirmed confidence in the Sangha. We will possess the virtues dear to the noble ones, unbroken, unstained, leading to concentration. It is in such a way that you should train yourselves. Venerable Sir, as to these four factors of stream entry taught by the Blessed One, these things exist in us, and we live in conformity with those things. For, Venerable Sir, we possess confirmed confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We possess the virtues dear to the noble ones, unbroken, and so on, leading to concentration. And the Buddha replies, it is a gain for you, Dhammadina. It is well gained by you, Dhammadina. You have declared the fruit of stream entry. So that, it's just as the Buddha exhorting the lay follower who was already very well established and solid. But even for a stream enterer or something, yes, some of these these discourses are not so easy to comprehend or to apply the mind to. Still, the Buddha is encouraging them. One of the most common ways in which the Buddha employed the concept of emptiness in his expositions was in reference to wise consideration of the five khandhas. And this sutta is from Samyutta 22, sutta number 95. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Ayodhya on the bank of the river Ganges. There, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, Bhikkhus, suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of form there is, whether past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to him to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in foam? Suppose, bhikkhus, that in the autumn, when it is raining and big raindrops are falling, a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of feeling there is, a bhikkhu investigates it, and it would appear to him to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in feeling? Suppose, bhikkhus, that in the last month of the hot season, at high noon, a shimmering mirage appears. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a mirage? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of perception there is, a bhikkhu investigates it, and it would appear to him to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in perception? Suppose, bhikkhus, that a person needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, would take a sharp axe and enter a forest. There they would see the trunk of a large plantain tree, straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. They would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the coil. As they unrolled the coil, They would not find even softwood, let alone heartwood. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in the trunk of a plantain tree? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of mental formations there are, a bhikkhu investigates them, and they would appear to him to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in mental formations? Suppose, bhikkhus, that a conjurer or a conjurer's apprentice would display a magical illusion at a crossroads. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a magical illusion? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of consciousness there is, a bhikkhu investigates it, and it would appear to him to be empty, hollow, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in consciousness? Seeing thus, bhikkhus, the wise, noble disciple experiences disenchantment towards form, disenchantment towards feeling, disenchantment towards perception, disenchantment towards mental formations, disenchantment towards consciousness. Experiencing disenchantment, they become dispassionate. Through dispassion, the heart is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge. It is liberated. They understand. Birth is ended. The holy life has been lived out. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming into any state of being. This is what the Blessed One said. Having said this, the Fortunate One, the teacher, further said this. And of course, it's in verse. Form is like a lump of foam, feeling a water bubble. Perception is just a mirage. Volition's like a plantain. Consciousness, a magic trick. So says the kinsman of the sun, which is another epithet for the Buddha. However one may ponder it or carefully inquire, all appears both void and vacant when it's seen in truth. So of course, this is a very well-known sutta, and a very important one, because it does give the relationship that is really important to establish toward the five khandhas, and within the five khandhas, that is what we take as me and as mine and belonging to me, and we suffer accordingly. We carry around that burden of carrying things that are insubstantial and making them, feeling that they're tremendously important. And just the attachment to the body and worry about aging, worrying about health, worrying about appearance, and the feeling that the pleasant, painful, neutral, just the we bounce around with these feelings, the things that how we perceive and cognize give meaning to the world around us is fundamentally insubstantial, like a shimmering mirage is constantly shifting and changing. And the insubstantiality of the mental formations, the thoughts, emotion, the plantain is like a big banana tree, and it's just it's like an onion,
like a leek or an onion.
Like a leek or an onion. But big, especially in the forest, you can have these huge, huge wild banana trees. You know, they'll be like this big around, and there's nothing there. You keep peeling it back and peeling it back. There's nothing there. And then the conjurer's apprentice, the magic trick, I mean, it's astounding what what magicians can do and seem to appear. But and that's what our mind does. That's what consciousness does. It creates worlds within worlds within worlds, and me inhabiting them all out of basically nothing, smoke and mirrors. That whatever we can do to help investigate and see its fundamental, empty, hollow, insubstantial nature, lends itself to this feeling of disenchantment and dispassion. And it's really important to recognize that the words that are used for disenchantment and dispassion in Pali are not associated with anything negative. The association, the accompanying mental state is very, very bright. And to be, to like the nibbida, to experience disenchantment, is not, it is intrinsically bright and wholesome. The mind is uplifted and buoyed up by that. And the same with dispassion. Because in English, you say that they are dispassion. It's like you don't feel anything. But the brightness of the mind of viraga is really, really important to sort of pay attention to that. In the Abhidhamma, delineation of mental states, that these are in completely wholesome and bright states of mind. Yeah.
How does that square with taking delight in the natural world?
Oh, you have to look on the world as awful and as dismal. Again, you have sort of look at it. You're looking at it with balance, because you can still be dispassionate and disenchanted with the world, but still appreciate its beauty. Like it's really interesting that the most dour, hardcore ascetic in the history of the Sangha at the time of the Buddha was Mahakasapa. And the most gushy verses in the Theragata, particularly about nature and looking at the world around him with kind of awe and wonder, come from Mahakasapa. It's actually quite striking, quite beautiful. Usually when we, and certainly say like the, oftentimes like romantic poetry, looking at the nature around, there's definitely a kind of a clinging there. Whereas for to looking at it through the lens of a Buddhist practice, you're seeing the whole thing. You can be delighted in the world around you, but you're not infatuated with it.
Speaking of poetry, so William Blake put it very beautifully and accurately, I would say, in I think it's in his Songs of Innocence and Experience, Joy. He says that he that binds himself to a joy doth the winged life destroy. He that kisseth a joy as it flies lives within it and lives in eternity's sunrise. So binding yourself to a joy doth the winged life destroy. So trying to keep that precious thing, that beautiful thing, then that's that urge to keep, to own, to have, to to relish, then that sours that. But the kissing the joy as it flies is what Mahakasapa was doing. That there's that the mind is imbued with the attitude of non-grasping, non-identification. So it's a mysterious thing that the more completely the heart lets go of the world, the more it can really enjoy it.
Yeah, like some of the people that I've met who just, you know, really enjoy life. And Ajahn Chah kind of was the greatest example. I mean, tremendous joy. But no illusions about the world around him. So
that's a bit like if somebody is very attached to ecology, but they have a real dread of towns and cities.
Exactly. Or that people who are dedicated to peacefulness and eco-friendliness are viciously critical and filled with hatred for people who are worldly and indulgent. And just I don't know how many times over the years it's very ironic and painful. But someone so dedicated to things that are wholesome and noble and good, but their very grasping of it makes them filled with criticism and anger and aversion, and they find themselves alienated and exhausted. So it's a painful irony that things work in that way. And that I would echo what Lumpo Pasana was saying, that some people who have really enjoy life because of basically the non-attachment, and that it's not the the kind of relishing of sensory experience that is the kind of an automatic affirmation. There can be that the heart's just natural rejoicing without kind of getting drawn in and getting carried away with sensory experience. And so it's something that the Buddha was extraordinarily rigorous in his expression, and just like you're talking about Lumpo Cha, you know, he seemed like the happiest man in the world, and he was receiving visitors 15 hours a day, 18 hours a day, lived on, you know, one meal a day, slept on a grass mat, no sex, no drugs, no rock and roll. was proud of the fact that Wat Pa Pong had the worst food in the world. And he was the happiest person you'd ever met. That was one of the things that really got my attention when I showed up as a sort of hippie off the beach, was like, how come this guy's so happy? This is a really austere living situation, but he's the happiest man in the world. How does this work? But going back to the reading, that the Lump of Foam Sutta, that I feel that one of the things that is kind of, and I think we talked about that a bit earlier in one of the earlier readings, is with respect to emptiness in that particular teaching, talking about emptiness in relationship to the five khandhas. There's with each of those five examples, the lump of foam, the water bubble, like when a raindrop hits the top of a pond and a bubble forms and so on. For each of those five, they're quite different from each other. But in each case, there's a form, but no essence. There's a shape. There is a shape. There's the mirage. There's the shape of the lump of foam, or there is the trick that the conjurer is doing. There's a shape, there's a form, but no essence, no substance. And so that's a significant element of that particular teaching. So when we are talking about, and I think the last reading we had, I was using the word transparency as a way of talking about emptiness, so that there's a shape, there's a form, but it's transparent. You can see through it, or like a shaft of sunlight. There's a shape, but there's no resistance when you walk through it. There's no pressure. And so in these reflections on emptiness, it's not a negation of the sensory experience, but it's a way of, in a sense, holding them in the attitude, with a spacious attitude, so that there's an appreciation of the shapes, the forms, the structures, but not adding anything to it.
Everything arises from emptiness, right?
No.
No.
Everything arises from causes and conditions.
But before arises is emptiness, and then something arises and ceases in the emptiness. No, it's not that.
That's an extrapolation. You're adding that to it.
You never hear you never find the Buddha saying that. Some Dhamma teachers,
do. Yeah, that's the poetry side of things.
It's arising from what?
Causes and conditions.
Cause and condition.
Yeah.
Cause and condition arising from where?
Causes and conditions. There is no discernible beginning to this world. Even that's the what we're looking for is an ending to it.
So we don't look in the original.
No. That's that. You give yourself a headache. You don't want to do that.
So there's a whole chapter of the Saṅyutta Nikāya called "On No Discoverable Beginning," and there's a whole sequence of very very similar sutras. I think it's chapter 17. I think of the Saṅyutta. Not sure. But anyway, they're quite similar suttas, but in each one the Buddha's illustrating how there is no discoverable, you can't describe a beginning. And then also he names it as one of the four acinteya, the four imponderables, that it's not a matter of not having enough information. The thinking mind can't represent the reality. So all the workings of karma, the range of the mind of a Buddha, the range of states of concentration, and the ultimate beginning of things, those are all acinteya, they're imponderable. And not because the Buddha's got the secret and he won't tell you, but but words and concepts can't encompass the reality.
It's on you to 15.
15, excuse me.
15, yeah.
Thank you.
17 is the Lapa Sankara, which is
there's
there's a great, those are sort of the Panchaya Suttas that the Buddha teaches. Okay.
Wasn't there everything arises from interest, and then there is a sequence.
Mm-hmm.
All things arise from interest and cease in.
Rooted in interest are all things. That's in the Anguttara, the Book of the Tens. Rooted in interest are all things. Born of attention are all things. Arising from contact are all things. Diverging into feelings are all things. So the first thing is rooted in interest. And so that's the... that is, you could say that's another way of talking about causes and conditions. There's a cause, there's a condition. Interest gives rise to the world of things.
Seems a little bit like a beginning.
Yeah, chanda.
Chandamula.
Yeah. Chandamula. So interest, desire, motivation. Yes.
I would like to pose a follow-up question to the relationship of nature and, you know, renunciation and realization. To which extent does, you know, especially in the forest tradition, where like nature also is a
thing. Yeah, it is a thing. Yeah.
Kuti dwellers, and you know, in the Tibetan tradition, there is similar, you know, sort of traditions. In which ways this is actually quite a big part, in the sense that when we engage with the natural world, which in itself kind of potentially is always, things are always changing, and you know, if trees are falling apart, you can see the plantain tree actually, you can see the water bubbles. But in the modern world where we are surrounded by, you know, oftentimes stagnant stuff or things that we attach to, our human relationships or whatever, in which way is this actually a key element? And what is then the answer, if it is, in the modern world where such conditions are so rare and becoming rarer and rarer, even like Long Paul said about the forest tradition, you know, the, sort of the hermitages who are now bombarded by music from the villages.
Yes, yes, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things is in terms of nature, yes, a natural setting is quite optimal, very supportive, very helpful. But the nature that Buddha is really trying to get us to see and understand is the nature of all conditioned things in terms of their impermanence, uncertainty, changing nature, the unsatisfactory, stressful, discontent that underlies the human condition because of desire and envy, not self, insubstantiality. So that, you know, in terms of nature, that's the nature that you want. You want to be using a natural setting to help to highlight that reality or that fundamental nature. But whether or not we live in a kind of a big city like London, or out in the forest in the wilds of Thailand, that fundamental nature is still there. And it actually requires. It's a being in a natural setting is a supportive condition. It's not the end game. And it's really helpful to have, in the same way that the Buddha puts a tremendous emphasis on Kalyanamitta, on spiritual friendships, and he encourages solitude. But you want to be paying attention to the supportive conditions that help to facilitate clarity and a willingness to relinquish and let go. So nature, if one is able to, drawing close to a natural setting is a great support for training and pursuing our interest in Dhamma. But when we're not in those supportive conditions, that isn't as if nature has gone away. Nature is really all around us. It's the nature of things.
I think, two powerful suttas where the Buddha likens the four foundations of mindfulness to one's ancestral territory.
Oh, right.
And, you know, that really resonates for sort of rootless Americans who don't have any ancestral territory whatsoever. So that sense of that's where you find it.
Cool. Also, in response to Venerable Yeshe's question, as Longpo was saying, the laws of nature are still functioning all the time. But what happens in human society or in urban situations and such like, is that we're surrounded by human-centered values, human-centered perceptions, and so that what is meaningful, what's important, is very much based around human wishes, human needs, human priorities, and so on. And so it's not that those are bad, but it's just that the key sort of principle of development of insight is going from a self-centered perspective to a nature-centered perspective. So that seeing things in terms of Dhamma. So even in the midst of a kind of, if you're standing on a tube train in London, like with 200 other people squished into the carriage, rather than being obsessed with, I hope I'm going to get to work on time, or I'm going to get to the venue when I'm supposed to, the mind can shift to, every single one of these bodies is breathing. All of us were born. Every single one of these bodies is going to breathe out and not breathe in again one day. We are all powered by hearts and lungs and livers and kidneys, and all these bodies are functioning according to laws of nature. So just that active contemplation of things in terms of natural order, rather than, did I get on the right tube train? Am I going to get there in time? Etc., etc. So that if you're in a situation where you've got less human constructions, then that nature-centered perspective is closer to the surface, and you haven't got so many kind of human things that the human hand has touched or affected. So it's more immediate, more obvious. You can still be in a forest with no other humans around and still be totally wrapped up in human-centered concerns. I speak from experience. But that's what is one of the benefits living in the countryside and then physical seclusion, is that those reminders are closer to the surface, and the dependent nature of this life. And so that the duttangas, which challenge food, sleep, personal space, physical comfort, they're all kind of, all 13 duttangas are aimed pretty directly at those sort of reptile brain territories. That you're challenging those presumptions that are made, so that you're bringing to light, oh yeah, this is a living body. Like, when I'd spent the rains retreat in 1988 there was only one kuti in the forest, Chuthurst. If you wanted water, you had to carry it to the kuti. There was no other supply. So you'd have to fill up the water tank and carry it up through the forest up to your kuti. So you have a very different relationship to water if you've carried if you carried it, a quarter of a mile from the water tap. So that, whereas in an ordinary sort of urbanized and sort of developed situation, just go to the tap and plenty of water, it's just there. And so that the duttangas are designed to help even more acutely bring those those natural systems to the surface. So we're less presumptuous, we're less sort of taking refuge in our kind of human centered values of comfort and personal space and so on and so forth, reliable food supply, etc.
And the sense of security is so, we get very flustered when something is not quite the way we're used to. And Ajahn Chah was a master at shaking that up. It was really, and just being in, especially in the early days of living at Wat Pa Pong, is a very large community, and never quite enough food. There was always a big ball of sticky rice, but. But yeah, there's just, that sense of, those primal needs of but it is, but yeah, you can be quite, get quite obsessed, and you've got this beautiful forest around you, and it really highlights those kind of that seeking of security, seeking of stability.
It's interesting that the word ascetic or asceticism in English comes from the Greek askesis, which is a word used for athletic training. So that and we use the word training a lot in our kind of monastic jargon, but that asceticism is in spiritual terms is very much based around training. And just as if you're an athlete, you would take it for granted that you've got to endure a lot of hardship and go through certain disciplines if you want to win the race, if you want to compete and do the best you can. There's certain limitations that you live with in order to develop those skills. So asceticism and the Dutanga practices, they're very much in that same kind of spirit. It's like developing spiritual strengths through the use of particular limitations and structures, so that those capacities are given more vitality, given more life, given more strength, and that in a way it helps the mind to not be so complacent or reliant on the self-centered or human-centered perspectives, but is respecting this living system as part of the natural order. And so, like at Wobbapong, if you're hungry, then you look around the forest, you go, well, I'm just another hungry being living in the forest. All these other creatures, the chickens, and the lizards, they're all hoping they're going to get something to eat today. And they're all kind of looking for, they're hungry and they're looking for something to eat. Oh, like, this hunger is just like their hunger. Uh-huh. This is what we experience as living beings. So it brings an empathy.
And we tend to, again, especially conditioned by some of the romanticism, the nature is somehow benign and kind of, it's all deer and butterflies. And it's not when you really live in a forest. Everything is competing to either eat each other or to get away from each other. It's not an easy place to get along. So nature has its other side, and there is beauty. Certainly is beauty, and in reality, say like just the monastery, the forest monasteries of Ajahn Chah in England, they're all in incredibly beautiful places. Certainly the we end up living in very beautiful circumstances. We're incredibly fortunate, but within that, there's a whole spectrum of benefits and drawbacks.
Are we going to get to the end of the chapter?
Well, I doubt it. Might make it. Okay. Over and over again, and throughout the Buddhist world, this collection of images appears as a vivid metaphor. Oops.
Found a typo.
For the realm of mind, as a vivid metaphor for the realm of mind and body. And this is from the Dhammapada, number 46, Knowing the body as false as foam, knowing it as a hazy mirage, knowing the barb in Mara's flowers, thus the wise elude death's lord. And then Dhammapada 170, they who look upon the world as unstable, insubstantial, as bubble, mirage, and illusion, they're the ones death cannot find. And these verses also, as Ajahn Amaro hears, these verses also bring to mind the Buddha's advice to Moga Raja, and that's from chapter 11. And this is from Sutta Nipata, verses 1118 and 19. As an appropriate way of closing the present chapter, here is another exchange from the section of Sutta Nipata in the preceding passage, The Way to the Beyond. So this is, these are Moga Raja's questions. This world, so Moga Raja, this world, the next world, the Brahma world with its devas, I don't know how they're viewed by the glorious Gotama. So to the one who has seen to the far extreme, I've come with a question. How does one view the world so as not to be seen by death's king? And the Buddha's response. View the world, Moga Raja, as empty, always mindful to have removed any view about self. This way, one is above and beyond death. This is how one views the world so as not to be seen by death's king. So those are, just to say, handy shorthand for finding the way out of all this. Any comments, questions? Well, we wrap it up.